everybody, to another edition of 18 in Life, the Pac-10 Hoops podcast. We've been on a little bit of a break. It was sort of unintentional, unintended, but Seth has been gallivanting around the country, and I've been busy, so that's sort of what it came down to. But here we are again. Jeff Neuser here from KookCenter.com, here for our final episode of the season, along with my co-host here, Seth Colin from SportsPressNW.com, where you can read his witty and crafty stylings each morning with Exit 164. And we last talked to you back before the tournament started, and now that it is the day after the tournament has ended, that seems like as good a time as any to talk about the tournament. So, Seth, as you were watching the game last night, tell me sort of – actually, how about let's talk about halftime. Like, what thoughts were going through your head when this game was, whatever it was, 22-19 at halftime?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I have to say I didn't watch most of the first half. I tend to not end up watching the championship game because it's always such a letdown after the whole tournament. But I showed up at this party where a bunch of people are watching the game. They're like, you just want to turn around and leave. This is terrible. Like, just avert your eyes and don't watch any of it. At least there was that guy hit that shot at halftime, you know. Yep. But at that point, it was kind of hard to care who won because it was such a horrible game. And I mean, I guess the only suspense was seeing if they were going to break Wazoo's record for shooting horribleness, which they actually managed to do.
Woohoo! Yay!
So now the new, so I mean, in case you didn't get the reference, the worst shooting performance ever in NCAA championship game was Washington State in 1941, and now Butler with what were they end up shooting 18% or something?
Yeah, it was horrendous, man.
It was has now successfully defeated that.
Well, and it was built on just tremendous 2-point defense by UConn, which was sort of like. The crazy thing is I think at one point they were like, you know, Butler was like 1-for-20 or something like that on 2-point shots, which, you know, and it's not like, I mean, Butler did miss some gimmies, you know, but for the most part, it was just UConn using their length inside in the interior. I mean, it got to a point later in the game where Matt Howard just wasn't even trying inside anymore. I mean, the ball came inside and he'd make a couple moves, which were pretty clearly designed just to throw the ball back outside.
And well, you know, it ended up being like, what, 1-for-12 or something?
Yeah.
1-for-12 inside. He couldn't do anything, you know, and people are like, you know, just get the ball inside. I don't know what you do. You know, I was like, as I was watching the game, I was like, well, they can't score inside. They can't shoot. So I don't know what you do then. I don't know. You get the ball to the middle? I don't know. There's not a lot you can do there. So, you know, they always say you got to, you know, inside outside. When you can't do any of them, then that's it. And what a run for Connecticut! I mean, to win the Big East championship, which I mean, in some ways is harder than winning the NCAA tournament, I think.
Well, and five games in 5 days definitely is harder.
Five games in 5 days against frankly better competition.
Right.
At least the first two, they're guaranteed to be probably better competition, and then. You know, and then to go and win the NCAA tournament. I mean, I don't even know. I mean, if you're a Connecticut fan, I mean, geez, what a month.
Yeah.
Amazing. I mean, I know the women's team lost or whatever, but if you're a Connecticut men's fan, then I mean, good gracious. So, I mean, you know,
I feel like this is a story that is only going to be appreciated as time goes by because I don't know. I mean, like I guess part of me was, you know, this was actually one of the, and this is sort of weird to say, but this is one of the least enjoyable NCAA tournaments I can remember in recent time for me personally to watch, which, you know, for a lot of people I think is sort of weird and the opposite of how they feel because, you know, there were so many upsets and you got VCU running deep and you got all this stuff going on. But, you know, personally, it's – I don't know. I like excellence and I sort of like a balance between the craziness and the excellence. And I felt like in general sort of this tournament was sort of – low on excellence and, you know, just watching, you know, teams just crap all over themselves as they tried to take, you know, the final shot of a game or, you know, whatever it was.
And the coaches too, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, there's this whole thing. And then, you know, with UConn, like, I don't know, there was just a part of me that sort of refused to buy into what they were doing because I was just like, they shouldn't even be here. And then I was like, they shouldn't have been a 3 seed. And then I was like, okay, at some point their legs are going to give out. I mean, in my bracket, I picked them to lose the first game like an idiot. You know, I mean, I'm like, you know, I'm like, no way.
Losing the first game. So
I'm like, no way their legs can hold up. And it did in the whole tournament. And they just, you know, as time goes by, I think I'm going to get more of an appreciation for what they accomplished, because sort of that peripheral stuff that was sort of annoying to me will sort of fall by the wayside, and then it'll be a thought of, okay, you know, UConn really did accomplish something incredibly special here with, you know, winning these sort of 11 – not sort of – winning these 11 straight games and, and winning the final two with some of the greatest, most suffocating defense I think I've ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, they, you know, I mean, holding due to 1 of 12 and, you know, just – they just couldn't do anything. I mean, you know, part of it, they obviously had kind of a crummy shooting night. I mean, they missed shots that they probably could have – would normally make, you know, shoot 18%. Without a little bit of bad luck, but you also don't shoot 18% without tremendous, tremendous defense.
Yeah,
by
correct.
And yeah, I mean, I know what you mean about, I mean, when Butler VCU is the national semifinal, I mean, if you'd have told me a month ago Butler VCU was on, I would have said, okay.
Yeah.
So glad, but, you know, but I mean, it was, the, you know, and it was, you know, it was a decent game, but, you know, I don't know. I mean, part of it is just college basketball getting frankly worse, because, you know, there's more options for guys to go into the league, and there's sort of less, you know, even the guys who do, you know, who are talented and who are playing college basketball are going into systems where they're sort of allowed to play, to sort of feature there. It's not really like a team game. It's not really like all these excellent players playing with each other. It's like a couple guys are featured and then there's some other dudes just hanging around, you know, almost as filler. So, you know, you watch some of the championship, some, you know, Final Four games from the 90s and it's just sick who's on all these teams, you know, like that, you know, like the Fab Four thing and all those guys. I mean, it's incredible. So, you know, to see Butler VCU, you know, I mean, Mac's a nice little player and, you know, Howard's good inside and, you know, VCU had, you know, was, you know, they're running a lot and that was kind of fun to see, but wasn't, you know, wasn't anything that I would stop what I was doing. Mind you, I watched it, so.
Of course you did, because we're sick, but yeah, it's, to me, I think, you know, you mentioned like, you know, these teams just aren't as good, and I think I sort of had an epiphany yesterday morning leading up to the game and just thought, I think the ultimate state of where sort of college basketball was this year was that neither one of the teams playing in the championship game last night was anywhere near as good as the two teams who played last year. You know, and it's like you just look at and I don't necessarily need a star-studded, you know, team. I mean, I think back to like, I don't know, like Illinois' North Carolina a few years ago where, you know, North Carolina had all these first round draft picks on their team. And even Illinois had some, you know, really good players and, or back to, you know, Memphis, Kansas, you know, where you had all those players as well on both teams, you know, Derrick Rose and, you know, whatever. But, you know, so I don't necessarily need that. I mean, I think back to last year's game and I go, okay, you know, that Butler team, yes, they, you know, Butler had Gordon Hayward, but, you know, they had these, you know, they had Willie Beasley and, you know, Shelvin Mack, who was sort of coming into his own and one of the, you know, more talented young guys in the country. And sort of, you know, that team to me was so superior to the team that took the floor for Butler last night. And it was, to me, it's like not even close, you know, and then I look at the Duke team that played last year. And I know people said, you know, well, geez, Duke returned all these guys and they should have been better. And I go, actually, that's a bunch. I think that was flawed analysis from the beginning because Duke really relied on their interior guy, Brian Zubek, for as overlooked as Brian Zubek was all of last year. He was huge for them in the tournament. He was their legitimate big guy. He cleaned up the defensive glass like crazy. He was an excellent offensive rebounder. I mean, he did this thing and they really this year really lacked toughness in the interior and it showed. And so you look at those two teams that played last year, you look at the two teams that played this year, and I don't think either one of those teams that played on Monday night that played last night could hold a candle to the two teams that played last year. And I think that's just sort of it in a nutshell. And I think these things go through cycles. You know, I don't know, people like to try and look at things and say, oh, this is the end of college basketball, or is this does this signify parity? And I go, well, I mean, we've had the one and done rule for how long now? Like 10 years or something? I mean, I mean, maybe not that long, but how long has it been? I mean, it's Carmelo Anthony, right? Was the first one, or maybe the class after him. So we're talking like 6 or 7 years now that this one and done rule has been in. And I don't know. I just don't think, I mean, we've gone through multiple cycles. I just don't see where that is sort of the driving force behind the sort of crappy play in college basketball this year. I just think it's cyclical.
Yeah, no, it's probably true. So, yeah, and it's hard a couple, you know, the day after you're kind of thinking, oh, this is the end. But you know, next year, you know, we'll probably have, you know, great teams in the final again. And we'll be celebrating a renaissance of college basketball. Yeah. So we should probably talk about the Pac-10 since the Pac-10 podcast. We've not mentioned a single Pac-10 team in 5 minutes.
So one of the teams that UConn had to go through to get there was the team that made it the deepest into the tournament for the Pac-10. That'd be Arizona, which represented the Pac-10 exceptionally well, I think. And would that be your take as well?
Oh, yeah, I would say so. Really impressive. And, you know, the fact that they're able to get back to the Elite Eight 2 years into Sean Miller's. I mean, I don't think anyone would have picked that. I mean, I would think you would call that absolutely best case, like wildly optimistic scenario when he took that job. You know, Huskies haven't been to the Elite Eight since 1953. It's not easy to get there, and for him to take them there, I mean, what an accomplishment. And, you know, Derek Williams, I think was probably, I mean, other than maybe Shaka Smith, was probably the, like, guy that got the biggest boost out of that tournament out of anybody, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I would think so. And, you know,
Kemba Walker maybe, but...
Yeah, but it was hilarious. You know, you always kept hearing like, oh, my gosh, you know, if this guy played here, we would have heard about him before. And I'm going like, you know, facepalm because I'm like, you know, this guy is amazing. And the fact that I think nobody or, you know, so few people seem to pay attention to the Pac-10, I think that both falls on the TV contract, which we have both, you know, lamented over and over again. But I think it also just – I think it just exhibits a lack of effort on people's parts. You know, it's like I understand it's not easy to find Pac-10 games most of the time, but it's not like Derek Williams has never been on national TV. I mean, he played the Huskies three times on national TV. You know, all three of those games.
I felt like it almost got to the point where people were, you know, one of those points where people say he's so underrated that he's like totally, you know, he's not underrated anymore when everyone's saying he's like the most underrated player. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, he, with his incredible, you know, and at what point you call his 65% or whatever it is shooting percentage from three that he basically kept going all year a fluke, I don't know. But, you know, his ability to take over in games once again, we saw him once again make like a, you know, end of the game block to save a game just like he did against the Huskies in Arizona in the regular season. And, you know, and I think he was the star player and is considered a top two pick by both Draft Express and NBADraft.net, which are the two that I know about that I look at, one in NBADraft.net and two in Draft Express, you know, based in large part on his performance, although I'm not entirely sure where he plays in the NBA, but I guess that's something you deal with down the road.
Yeah, and I don't know that really matters. I mean, I think smart NBA teams just go, okay, we're just going to stockpile talent and we're going to figure out how to make them play together. And, you know, it was just sort of amazing to me, you know, one last thought on him and people's perceptions. You know, people kept – they just sort of had this, wow, can you believe what this guy can do? And I'm like, I've been watching this. He's not doing anything he hasn't been doing all year. You know, he's been incredible all year. So yeah, that was great to see Arizona go deep. You know, I was very disappointed. They were one of the teams I was incredibly disappointed in for the end of game execution against UConn, settling for a Derek Williams sort of off balance three. And then they did end up getting the offensive rebound and Jamel Horn actually got an exceptional look, which I actually thought he made
that was going in. I mean, he hits that shot so often. I thought for sure that was going in. It really was very close.
Yeah. So, you know, if it wasn't for that, they'd be in the Final Four and UConn would not be winning the championship. So very strange in that respect. But yeah, I think, you know, the Pac-10, I think, has to be proud of how this tournament went. I mean, Arizona obviously making it to the Elite Eight, one shot, you know, one possession away from the Final Four. And then you've got, you know, Washington, which showed itself very well in its two games, you know, took North Carolina to the limit, a game that, of course, Husky fans will swear they should have won. But, you know, whatever. It just is sort of like, you know, Washington played well. UCLA went out and smoked Michigan State before going out in the second round. And, you know, just all these teams really, I think, you know, USC obviously sort of face planted. That was, by the way, our guaranteed winner of the tournament.
Our guaranteed winner of
our lead pipe lock was USC beating VCU.
Oh, God.
Yes, we would be remiss if we went through this whole podcast and didn't eat a little crow and wipe the egg off our face. But,
they got run too. Shoot.
Yeah, and actually they put up almost a better fight against VCU than maybe some other teams did too, which was sort of crazy. But anyway, you know, I think other than that, you know, other than USC's sort of face plant against VCU, which again doesn't look quite so bad in retrospect. But
no, definitely not.
Yeah. So other than that, though, I mean, I'd say Washington and UCLA both comported themselves well, and I think the Pac-10. I think this is a sign that that the Pac-10 is, you know, essentially back on the upswing. I think.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, last year, you know, only the one. Wait, how many teams we have in the tournament last year? Two teams in the tournament last year. Yeah.
Yep.
And you know, nobody that really made. I mean, you know, the Huskies made the Sweet 16 again, but yeah, I mean, UCLA won a game. Huskies won a game and took North Carolina down to the wire. And probably, I don't know. I mean, I watched a few of the games. It had to be one of the more entertaining games of the year. Of the tournament, I mean, and yeah, I mean, I thought definitely, I mean, the teams, the winning two games and sending a team to the Elite Eight out of four is, I think, pretty solid.
Yeah, I think so. And I think another thing that is sort of underrated in this as well is, you know, for, you know, this offseason, at least it looks like there are rumblings about Kevin O'Neill potentially maybe like having problems down at USC because of his Pac-10 tournament issue. But getting in a drunken fight with a fan of another Arizona fan, I think, or something. But
yeah,
anyway.
Arizona fan. Yeah.
So anyway, but beyond that, it appears at least that there's not going to be any coaching turnover in the conference. And I think that, again, you know, we talk about these things being cyclical. It seems to me that's sort of part of it, too, is you've got this situation where now we've got some continuity. There were some changes last year, most notably at Oregon. But now it seems like, okay, you've sort of settled in. You know, these teams are getting, you know, some of these guys are getting to be upperclassmen. The coaches have been around for a couple of years. I think you're seeing some stability brought to the conference, and I think that's going to pay off during the next conference season as well.
Well, I mean, stability among 10 of the programs.
Yes.
Next year we add two more programs, that's, you know, going to reflect on the conference one way or the other. You know, when if Colorado gets blown out in their, you know, in some, you know, non-conference game at, you know, School of Mimes or something like that, we're gonna go, oh, at Pac-10. And Utah just announced a new coach yesterday or today, I believe. So yeah, I mean, that in the, throw that into the mix. I think of the of looking at the conference.
Yeah, and Utah is a program that's in a little bit of upheaval at the moment. You know, they you know, going to another coach. You know, they have yet to find the magic coach since Rick Majerus left them. Went from Ray Giacoletti, who was the head coach at Eastern Washington, highly regarded in coaching circles, goes to Utah and sort of flames out. And then Jim Boylan comes in, and 4 years later, he's out. And so now they've moved on to Larry Christowiak, who was sort of an interesting hire in that he was the coach at Montana for a couple of years, then went off to the NBA, was an assistant, and was supposedly sort of in line for the job when Boylan got hired, but ended up not taking it because he ended up getting the Milwaukee Bucks, I think is what it was. But anyway, ended up getting hired as the head coach in the NBA, which is sort of, you know, you don't really turn that down. So so he did that for, I don't know, what, like half year and a half or something. And now he's back in the college game. And it's sort of interesting to me. And, you know, I'm not totally familiar with the situation, but it's interesting to me that this is sort of being met with a collective yawn in Salt Lake City, in that, you know, here's a guy who was successful at Montana. And maybe that's it. Maybe it's just, it was a couple of years in Montana and then he went to the NBA. And, you know, so maybe that's sort of the issue, is that, you know, there's not really a long track record for fans to hang their hat on. I know the SB Nation blog, Block U, guy's pretty well connected and was reporting that they were way down the road with Randy Bennett before Randy Bennett backed out, the coach at St. Mary's. He backed out, and then some other guys sort of backed up that version of the story. Andy Katz was a guy who backed up that version. And so, you know, Randy Bennett was the guy they really wanted. Randy Bennett was the guy that fans really wanted. He backed out for whatever reason. Seems like maybe some people are a little leery at this point of the AD out there at Utah, who seems to sort of be going through basketball coaches. And I don't know. It's interesting to me that a guy who has NBA coaching experience is sort of not, you know, drawing more interest or excitement from the fan base. But I don't know.
But, Yeah, not only that, I mean, he was at Montana for 2 years. He took over a team that had like 10 wins the year before and takes him to the NCAA tournament with, you know, a solid winning record. The next year, they go to the tournament again and they win 24 games and they win a game in the tournament. I mean, he's had success at the college level. He's had not sustained success, which, I mean, you know, I mean, he hasn't built a program, you know, 2 years, you know, I mean, that's somebody else's recruits and that's, you know, maybe him not, you know, showing that he can go out and build a program. But I mean, heck, you know, it's tough to get those people that have done it. I mean, they don't have to go to, you know, Utah. They can go to sort of bigger schools. So, and he's coached in the NBA, which other than Mike Montgomery, that makes him the only Pac-10 coach with NBA head coaching experience, which is going to be a big draw. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. You know, it's one of these things where, you know, no one ever thinks the coach that they get is good enough. And just reminds me immediately of, you know, when the Huskies hired Lorenzo Romar, who famously was their fifth choice, but has been the best coach that the school's ever had. I think you can say without really any argument right now. I guess there's another fan base in the Pac-10 that refuses to accept mediocrity, which is, you know, I guess good.
Yeah, and I mean, they got sort of spoiled there under Majerus and, you know, Final Four and NBA players and all those things. So it'll be interesting to see what they can bring to the conference. Colorado looks like, you know, they're bringing, you know, a good team to the conference. That's a team that advanced, you know, fairly deep into the NIT, which is nice. You know, I mean, I know the NIT is not everybody's favorite sporting event up here in Seattle. I got in a little bit of a Twitter fight with a sports radio DJ about the NIT and just sort of, he was belittling it. And I was like, well, you know, I mean, come on, it's sort of fun and you get to still watch your team, which is kind of cool. Right. So, but you know, it's, I suppose all of that could change if their best player decides to, head off to the NBA, which is apparently an option at this point. But, you know, adding these two teams, you know, it doesn't seem to me that it's going to substantially change the profile of the conference. It seems to me that Utah is probably going to be projected to be a bottom half of the conference type of team, although they do have a lot of young players. So there's potential there. And then Colorado, you know, should be a solid team and maybe perhaps, you know, boost the overall profile of the conference a little bit by being the sort of team that could maybe wedge its way into the tournament. Maybe another way that we should take a look at the conference as it might change for next year is take a look at the guys who are going to be departing. There are a couple of guys who have already declared and said that they are not coming back at all. And one would be Isaiah Thomas at Washington and another one, Tyler Honeycutt at UCLA. Both of these were surprising to me when I heard them. And the more I thought about it, only one of them remained surprising. So let's start with the one that is surprising to me. And that's Tyler Honeycutt, because he frankly did not have that good of a year. He was not an efficient scorer. He was I would say an above average defender and a pretty decent rebounder for his size, but did not strike me as a guy who's ready for the NBA. And I know that's not necessarily the benchmark, you know, whether you're ready for the NBA, but doesn't strike me as the kind of guy that scouts are going to be, or that GMs are necessarily going to be enamored with either. Was that sort of your take, or did you have a different thought on that?
Well, you know, I mean, you know, we talked, I think our last episode, we talked a lot about, you know, him making the Pac-10, all Pac-10 team. You know, I mean, he's got the type of body that coaches are terrified of, because he's, you know, he's tall and he's quick and, you know, he can play a lot of positions on the floor, he can handle the ball, he can shoot. So, I mean, he has a lot of, you know, potential skills, and he has, I mean, the most important thing for the NBA is NBA body, and he's got that. So, you know, I don't think he's, you know, I mean, to me, if you can avoid it, don't come out when, you know, you are sort of, if you're an underclassman, you're sort of on that, because the magic number is the first round. If you make the first round, you get a guaranteed contract and you're not set for life, but you're darn close.
Right.
I mean, it's $1 million. So shoot, you know, you get, that's 30th, you get drafted 31st. Nothing. So to me, you want to kind of try to be safely in that first round if you can. And Honeycutt, you know, now he's listed as the second pick in the second round, which would be kind of a bummer. And you know, why? You know, maybe he can be coming back, being a featured player on that team, and, you know, kind of improve those skills that he does have to the point where people are saying, here's a guy, if he could shoot, you know, if he, you know, had better ball handling skills, you know, he could be an NBA player right now, you know, to be saying, oh, you know, that guy's an NBA player right now.
Right. Yeah, he just strikes me as a slightly taller but sort of substantially worse version of Klay Thompson. I mean, he's – Honeycutt's what, 6'8", right, I think?
Well, he's – I mean, athletic, I mean, I think he's got more – he's got more athleticism.
He does. He does. But he's – but, I mean, more or less, he's basically just a little taller. He's got a similar skill set. He blocks – I mean, he blocks a few more shots than Thompson, and I would – you know, I would ascribe that to being 6'8". But, you know, right. He's a slightly better rebounder because, again, he's 6'8". But really, the rest of his – yeah. But the rest of his peripherals are basically – the same sort of skill set, except that he is way worse at them. He doesn't assist very much. He doesn't handle the ball very well. He turns the ball over way too much for a guy who handles the ball as little as he does. He doesn't make a great amount of two-pointers, and he doesn't shoot the three particularly well. So I'm just kind of like, I don't know. I mean, I guess because he's taller, you know, he's sort of a two-guard skill set at 6'8", so maybe some NBA GM is going to find that incredibly attractive. But, you know, it is sort of an odd thing to me, especially, like I said, as I watched Klay Thompson all year and I watched Honeycutt, and I just kind of went, you know, there's really no contest between the two of them. And apparently either Honeycutt thinks he's ready or he, you know, is being shoved out the door by Ben Howland. And, you know, who knows what the real story is there, because I'm not going to pretend that I do. The other guy who's leaving, and this one initially surprised me but didn't surprise me the more I thought about it, and that's Isaiah Thomas. So I'm going to turn the floor over to you and see some of your thoughts, since you're a Husky fan, your thoughts on Isaiah Thomas leaving the University of Washington for the NBA without looking back.
Well, my thoughts are similar as yours. At first I thought, oh gosh, you know, what's he doing? What's he thinking? But, you know, when you really start to look at the factors that are involved in his decision, and also just sort of what he wants and what the type of person that he is, it was interesting to contrast it with Jake Locker's decision not to come out his junior year, to come, even though he was supposedly going to be the number one pick in the draft, which Isaiah Thomas definitely will not be. But, you know, it got a lot of, people thought he was making a big mistake to come back, but he wanted to be at UW. And Isaiah Thomas said very specifically that his dream, he went to the UW because his dream is to play in the NBA. That's why he was here, to get to the NBA. And, you know, the factors going into it are, A, they've shortened the amount of time that you, if you don't declare, that you can sort of display yourself to scouts. There's not enough time, he feels, for him to get out there and do workouts. That's one thing. Second thing is he took 5 years for high school. He took a year at a prep school, 2 years at a prep school, really, but a long, you know, 5 years before, from eighth grade to freshman year of college. So he's 22 now, and maybe is getting sick of, you know, hanging out with, you know, 18, 19, 20-year-olds in college and going to class and all that stuff, and is ready to kind of start, get going. And three is, I mean, the issue with his game is he's short. He's not going to get any taller. So it's difficult for me to see how, and, you know, next year with, you know, Abdul Gaddy coming back, he's not going to be, you know, Romar tried to downplay the fact that we don't have a point guard in my system, blah, blah, blah. But the fact is he's not going to be a two guard in the NBA. He's going to have to be a point guard, and he's not going to play point guard at UW. So, you know, he's not really helping his development any by coming to the UW, back to the UW. And yeah, he would, if he came back, he'd be the UW's leading scorer. They'd have a tremendous team. He could lead us into the Final Four, you know, similar to the way Kemba Walker did, maybe for Connecticut. But he doesn't care. I mean, it's not really his dream. His dream is to go to the NBA. So to me, you know, he's kind of making the right choice for himself.
Yeah, I mean, what could he accomplish at Washington that he hasn't already accomplished, or that wouldn't be – you know, I mean, about the only thing would be a really deep NCAA tournament run. I mean, that's right. I mean, if you're talking like final, you know, making a Final Four or winning the tournament. But you look at what he's accomplished in his 3 years at Washington. He was, as a freshman, he was a part of a team that won the Pac-10 outright. He was, as a sophomore, he was a part of a team that won the Pac-10 tournament. And as a junior, he was a part of a team that won the Pac-10 tournament. He won Pac-10. He won NCAA tournament games each year. I mean, he's, you know, I mean, the guy, I don't know. I mean, I just don't know what there is really left for him to call. I mean, Pac-10 player of the year, but, you know, I mean, his goal is to play in the NBA. He's not going to get taller. And the reality is, I think there were times this year that I looked at him, and honestly, I think that the he was starting to show some signs of wear. And it's not, you know, when you play when you play the brand of basketball that he has to play at his size, you know, he's got to initiate a lot of contact. He's got to, you know, really put the ball on the floor a lot, you know, sort of all of these things that take a toll on your body. And I think as we saw as the year went on and he was starting to play, you know, 35, 36, 37, 38 minutes a night, you know, all of a sudden, you know, it's not that he looked a step slow, but he just looked a little weary to me, you know, and
well,
I don't
he
know
collapsed
if
at the end of the, you know, at the end of the Arizona game, he collapsed on the court, you know, after hitting that shot to how he, you know, hits a shot to win a basketball game. And then, you know, but he's so tired that he collapses on the court after the game. I mean, yeah, he's playing ridiculous minutes and taking a ridiculous amount of really hard. I mean, does he want to come back in and bruise with Reeves Nelson, you know, and all these guys again next year? Yeah, that's a really good point. And, you know, and if he, you know, he gets knocked down hard on his shoulder and, you know, ruins it. I mean, that's, you know, that's it. He doesn't get, you know, he doesn't get a, you know, lifetime stipend from the UW. So I think, you know, one other thing I think people sort of knee jerk say, oh, you should stay in school, but you can't stay in school forever. You know, you have to come out at some point. I mean, if he comes out this year, he comes out next year, he's going to have to come out. So like, you're not going to be a high pick in the NBA draft is not necessarily a reason to come back because you may not become that high pick. I mean, Tyler Honeycutt to me is a different situation. He's a younger, you know, he's a younger player, 2 years younger, and he's obviously got skills that he could develop. But to me, Thomas, you know, and Lorenzo Romar said this, he said, you know, he said scouts have pretty much seen what they're going to see from Thomas. I don't see what he's going to be able to show them next year that they haven't already seen. So, so yeah, I mean, it's a big hit for UW for the Huskies, no question about it. Next year, they would have, I'm sure, once again been the favorites in the conference with Thomas coming back. He would have been the favorite for Pac-10 Player of the Year for sure. But they've got a decent crop of guards coming in, including Tony Roten, who's one of the top recruits in the country. And it's just going to be a little bit different team next year.
Of course, those two guys aren't the only guys who have already declared and are going to go. Nikola Vucevic has already decided to go, but I think that was sort of a foregone conclusion with him. I think most people figured he was gone, and you know he's sort of been my favorite, most underrated player in the Pac-10 the last couple of years. Is a guy who is very skilled for a big man, excellent rebounder, and he sort of breaks the, I guess, European player stereotype just a little bit. Tough player inside. He does have sort of a
He'll mix it up.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he has a perimeter-oriented offensive game in a lot of ways, but he's certainly not afraid to get down low, mix it up. He's, like I said, a superior rebounder, the best rebounder in the conference outside of some guy who plays in Arizona who's probably headed to the NBA too. But really, really excellent rebounder, and so he will do very well in the NBA. In fact, there's a chance that, you know, and I think a very good chance that, you know, even if Klay Thompson, some of the other guys we're about to talk about, come out, I think there's an excellent chance that Vucevic actually ends up being the second Pac-10 player selected after Derek Williams. Mm-hmm. Williams has not declared yet, but I think we're basically of the same mind that that's sort of a foregone conclusion.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any special knowledge of whether, you know, of his disposition towards staying in college basketball or not. I mean, he's 19. You know, he may want to, you know, experience college in the same way that, you know, some other players have recently. But he's, you know, like I said, he's a top two pick, considered a top two pick by the two major draft services. So, and what else he has to prove in college other than just, you know, leading a very good college team is sort of beyond me. But I think you'd have to assume that he would be coming out. But like you said, he hasn't said anything. A lot of other guys have.
Yeah, and I don't know, maybe he's just waiting for the tournament to die down, and maybe he wants to have a big press conference or something, I don't know. But, you know, and we don't, like, you know, you and I both said, you know, or like you just said, and I was thinking that, you know, neither of us have any sort of special insight, but at the same time, it's sort of, you know, we talked about how his performance in the tournament sort of has people talking about him as a potentially, you know, top one, two, or three type pick. You know, why a guy like that would come back seems a little, it just seems like that doesn't normally happen, I guess, that a guy would.
There's a good way to put it, yes.
Yeah, that normally comes back. So I don't think that, you know, I think that to me that seems like that's probably what's going to happen there. Other notable guys around the conference, Klay Thompson was a guy who was in the mix for Pac-10 Player of the Year, you know, for part of the year, and he has not declared yet. I say yet because I'm fully anticipating that he will at the very least declare but not hire an agent. But at the same time, maybe we could talk about this briefly because this seemed to play into Isaiah Thomas's decision, maybe just a little bit at least, is that the NBA – or not the NBA, the NCAA – has shortened the window of guys to sort of get their input and then make their decision. The NCAA has a, I believe it's a May 8th mandated deadline for deciding to withdraw from the draft if you want to return to school. And it's not an NBA deadline. It's an NCAA deadline. Right. And basically it's 10 days after these players are allowed to start having contact with teams. And so what they're basically – what the NCAA has said, you have to – if you're going to go through this process, you have to gather all the information you can and make your decision in 10 days. And that to me seems a bit ridiculous.
You know, I mean, my God. You know, I mean, I don't know. The NCAA, I swear, sometimes – and, of course, people – Husky fans are especially upset about this because Isaiah Thomas said that he might not come out if he had more time to do that. What interest the NCAA has in limiting the amount of information that underclassmen could get about potentially, you know, using their God-given abilities and you know – talent that they worked on during college, like an extreme number of hours a week to figure out what the best decision is for their future. I mean, would they do this with like, you know, do they don't do this to like, you know, third year law students or something and say, okay, you've got 10 days to like see whether you're getting an offer from a tax firm. And if not, then, you know, I don't know. It's just, I'm sure there's some rationale behind the rule, but you know what, you know, I don't even want to think about it. It's just so disturbing. But anyway, I'm probably less annoyed. I probably wouldn't be quite so annoyed if it, you know, weren't playing into Isaiah Thomas's, you know, potential reason for leaving. But it just seems like, why wouldn't you just let them put their name in the draft and then decide to come? I mean, baseball players get to, you know, get drafted,
yeah,
and then come back if they want. Like, why do basketball players get 10 days to decide whether or not they're going to even be in the draft?
Yeah.
Like, you know what, like our baseball players are so much smarter or like better equipped to, I don't know. It's just odd and strange. So anyway, yeah. So Thompson, you know, if he, you know, I mean, what's your, you know, you said you're pretty sure he's going to come out. You think it's just, that's just, he's sort of, you know, finished with Wazoo after kind of the upheaval this year, or he, you know, he's ready. You know, he just seems like he's more interested in the NBA, or.
I think that's what it is. I mean, he if you were to basically replace Isaiah Thomas's name with Klay Thompson's name in the press conference, you know, quotes, I think you'd probably hear the exact same words out of Thompson's mouth. I think he has, you know, to be honest, I think he has grown to appreciate Wazoo as a place. I don't think anybody who watched, you know, the last game that they won there against Northwestern before heading off to Madison Square Garden in the NIT, I don't think anybody could watch that game and think, hey, this is a guy who clearly just doesn't care about his college. You know, I think he's grown, you know, to like and love Pullman, but you have to remember, I mean, it's a guy from California. This is a guy who really wanted to play like at UCLA or USC. And neither one of those schools gave him the time of day until he blew up as a senior. Well, at that point, he'd already committed to Washington State, and he actually signed an early letter as well. But, you know, he had already committed, already signed his letter, and his dad was like, uh-uh, no way. You are going to – that was the – you know, these guys – and his dad, of course, for the thousandth time was Michael Thompson, former first-round draft pick Michael Thompson, you know. And – which, of course, Fox has to cite on every broadcast, which is why I was sort of joking about it. But anyway, you know, his dad was sort of like, no, you know, this is Tony Bennett invested the time in you and you made a commitment. So you need to follow through with that commitment. You need to go to Pullman. And so he went, and I don't think it was sort of, you know, begrudgingly, but at the same time, I think he sort of, this is a guy who's incredibly driven to play in the NBA. And I think that he sees college, you know, the way a lot of basketball players who want to play in the NBA do, is it's a vehicle. It's a vehicle to get where he wants to be. And so I don't think, you know, and you know, we sort of refer to the Jake Locker story up here because, you know, we're both located in the Seattle area. But, you know, I don't think, you know, for comparison's sake, I don't think you're going to see a Jake Locker type story out of Klay Thompson. You're not going to see him say, you know, I love being a Cougar so much that I'm willing to stay. Do I think that he likes the school? Yes. Do I think that he's created an appreciation, you know, grown fond of the place? I think probably, but ultimately he wants to play in the NBA, and that's his goal. And his father was a professional athlete. You know, he's got a brother who's a professional athlete, younger brother who's a professional athlete now. You know, I just think that that's ultimately his goal. And if, you know, if there's a reason for him to go and he thinks he's going to make it, I think he's going to go. And I think even if, you know, I think even if he's considered to be a borderline second rounder, first rounder, like right in that, you know, 30 to 40 type range, 25 to 35 range, whatever you want to call it, I think I could see him probably still going. But, you know, who knows? I think he really, really wants to be in the NBA. And, you know, some decisions make you wonder how badly he wants to be in school, things like smoking weed and, you know, getting arrested for it and things like that. And, you know, I just don't know that, like, you know, coming back to WSU and becoming an icon, which is what would happen if he came back and led that team to the NCAA tournament, he would shatter every meaningful record that the school's ever held. He's already scored, I don't know, I think 1,700, 1,800 points in his career. The record is just over 2,000. Isaac Fonte. Yeah. I mean, he'll have that done by, you know, before the non-conference season is over. You know, he'll shatter that. So, you know, he could, if he wanted to be an icon, he could come back and do the Jake Locker thing. I just don't see him as being the kind of person that's going to do that. And so, you know, to me, with the 10-day window, I think what that does is I think that causes guys to actually end up in the draft, which is why I don't really like that rule. Not because it causes guys to end up in the draft, but I'm not positive it's the best thing for the kids. And not that that's necessarily what the NCAA is always in. I mean, they say that's what they're always interested in, but this rule is pretty clearly designed for the coaches and to protect the schools. But I think it actually has the opposite effect. Guys who might otherwise pull their name out, you know, end up staying in because that's, I think that's just human nature. So.
Right, exactly. Like, they want to get drafted, you know? I mean, the NCAA, you know, it's like all these things where you get these people making these rules and they just don't understand the motivations of the people that are going to be impacted by the rule at all. I mean, these guys want to go to the NBA. They want to get paid. And, you know, if it's a choice between, oh, I'm, you know, if I may get drafted, they're probably going to go for it. I mean, getting drafted is a huge – I mean, it's not like that. It's a huge honor to get drafted.
Sure.
I mean, for, you know, I mean, it's like what guys talk about. I mean, everyone, even me, is like an 8-year-old. You think about like getting drafted, like that's a huge deal. So, you know, yeah. So, I mean, it'd be cool to see Thompson come back. And I think I do think he's a guy that does sort of have something to prove at the college level. But yeah, I can also see that he'd want to go. And the other guy, Malcolm Lee from UCLA.
Yep.
Also in that same boat where he has not hired an agent, but is considering. And I thought Malcolm Lee, you know, did a heck of a job in the. When we talked before the tournament about his injury that might have made it hard for him to deal with Kalen Lucas in Michigan State.
Yeah,
he did an amazing job in that game against, you know, one of the top scorers in the NBA, I mean, in college basketball, you know, maybe not necessarily an NBA level talent, but a tremendously fast player. And at 6'5", being able to deal with that, I think is pretty impressive. If I were an NBA GM, I would be enjoying the tape of that. He wasn't consistent this year, but his defense certainly was. And that's, you'd think, probably going to be Malcolm Lee's ticket to the league.
You would think. And I think that, you know, it's going to be interesting to see because unlike Isaiah Thomas, where you talked and it was the same sort of sentiment I sent out on Twitter was, you know, I'm not sure how much room there is for development. You know, he kind of is what he is at this point. And but Malcolm Lee and Klay Thompson both, you know, those are both guys that I think could substantially – I think Malcolm Lee could be like a – honestly like a dark horse Pac-10 player of the year type of guy if he came back. Klay Thompson wouldn't be a dark horse type of guy. But, you know, there is still room for him to develop things. He made huge leaps and bounds developments. But he could – I mean, he could almost, you know, make himself into – you know, a bit of a his stats, actually, if you look at his tempo free stats, they compare very favorably to a guy named Evan Turner, who was at Ohio State. You know, if you look at him now, he wasn't as He wasn't as good as Evan Turner was in his junior year, but he did a lot of the same sorts of things, and I could see him becoming an even better all-around player, better ball handler, better able to go both hands to the basket, you know, those kinds of things that he'd be able to develop at the college level that are going to be harder to develop maybe at the NBA level. So, you know, there's room for development, but I don't begrudge either one of these guys if they both stay in because, you know, I mean – what do you do? You know,
I mean, I think the other thing that, you know, you probably don't understand necessarily when you're younger is the impact of sort of luck and exposure on, you know, how well you end up doing in your professional career, whether it's anything really, but especially sports. And, you know, if Thompson's able to take that team to the tournament and get into the tournament and have a big game or two, I mean, you know, I just think the impact of that is, especially given the fact that he's going to be the guy. I mean, he was the guy on that team this year, but he's going to be the guy on that team next year. You know, I mean, you can't tell me that Wally Szczerbiak has the same career he has if he doesn't put up 43 in the NCAA tournament.
Right.
If they don't make that tournament for whatever reason, which I'm sure they were, you know, pretty close to it. I mean, I think they were. They'd won their conference or whatever. You know, Derek Williams is not the number two pick in the draft if Arizona loses in the first round of that of the NCAAs, which they very nearly did. Actually, I can't remember. They were close, though. It was a close game, I think.
Let me look. Like, keep talking while I look.
Like, or something? Am I losing it?
They had a very close game against Memphis. There you go.
Memphis, that's what it was.
And then had another very close game against Texas before blowing Duke's doors off.
That was awesome. But, yes. So I think, you know – I mean, you know, I guess that partially goes for Thomas as well. But anyway, yeah, Lee, I think, you know, especially offensively, but at the same point, I feel like he's, you know, he hasn't really developed offensively. He's obviously not a great offensive player. But if you're going to be in that second round, which is, I'm just looking at Draft Express now, and the guys we've talked about, just for reference sake, Derek Williams is number two. They have him going number two. They don't have any other Pac-10 players going in the first round. They have Vucevic or Honeycutt going 32nd, so second in the second round. Honeycutt, Vucevic going 36th, 6th. Malcolm Lee going 11th in the second round. Klay Thompson going 12th in the second round. Justin Holiday, a senior, going 14th in the second round. And a name we'll all remember down near the bottom, Michael Dunnigan, the former Oregon player,
yeah,
somewhere, God, Turkey or somewhere this year, as the second to last pick in the second round. So, and Isaiah Thomas, they have Isaiah Thomas as the 25th pick in the second round. It is nice to see NBA names back in the NBA draft. We had not very many last year, but Landry Fields sure did represent the conference well. And you wonder if, you know, Thompson is a sort of Landry Fields-esque player in my mind.
Yeah, he definitely could be. And, you know, talking with our friend, our common friend here, Kevin Pelton, you know, about Klay Thompson, and the point that he made with me was that this is a draft light on shooting guards, you know. And so you know, there just aren't that many of them. So if Thompson does decide to come out, that, you know, there's a chance that he could actually end up drafted higher than he might otherwise be because, you know, there's just not a lot of shooting guards. And so some team may get a little bit enamored with, you know, the fact that he's a 6'6 guy who can shoot, you know, 40% from three. So
if you can do one thing well in the NBA, shooting the basketball into the basket is one of the better ones.
Right. Now, so, you know, it comes down to, is that one skill enough to get, you know, a team enamored with him? But, you know,
yeah,
we'll see. And, I mean, it's, you know, Draft Express. I mean, I'm looking at them right now. You know, they've got Thompson listed at 55th. So, you know, who knows?
Who knows? Yeah.
Who knows?
So I think we'll end it by talking about the one Pac-10 team that was the last team to play, who ended up winning their 20th game and a championship, the third, I believe, college basketball invitational championship won by Oregon State, is now in its third year, won by Oregon.
Yeah.
And I mean, holy heck, congratulations to the Ducks, right? I mean, And it was sort of a weird, you know, on the, like a, you know, one of these, you know, he couldn't have scripted it any better deals where Dana Altman, who had left Creighton and come to Oregon, and who does Oregon end up playing in the three-game CBA final?
Yes.
Creighton, yeah. And winning, beating them in the third and final game, which seemed like it was a heck of a lot better game than that stupid game last night.
Yeah, and it was decided, of course, by the notoriously missing,
so with like, under a minute left, one of Creighton's backcourt players, you know, accidentally dribbles back over that midcourt area where there's no line. How the refs decide where it is, I don't know, but they do, and so they get an over and back violation, and then Oregon's able to score the winning basket. So. So, you know, it's, it was funny. We were talking about it before that they always say, you know, so we said all year, some that's going to come into play, you know, some game, somebody's going to do that. And sure enough, and, you know, I mean, it's the CBA championship, but still, you know, a championship game. That's the time when somebody accidentally hops over that line. So, yeah, I mean, it was neat to see Oregon in there. I don't think anyone really paid attention at all whatsoever, but kind of a fun way to kick off that, probably the best they could have. I would say before the year, probably the best they could have hoped for would be winning the CBI would have been a pretty lofty goal, I would say.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, it's sort of a weird thing because, you know, and this I guess gets to the heart of, you know, what you know, I was talking about with the NIT, which is, you know, how much value is there in it really? And, you know, from a fan's perspective, it's cool. Your team's still playing and, you know, your team's winning stuff. And, you know, I mean, with WSU, it was like, hey, you know, we won three games. Did it completely change the way I viewed the season? You know, it didn't, because this was still sort of the same inconsistent team, which is we saw when they went to Madison Square Garden and got their faces kicked in by Wichita State, which I will say this, though, Wichita State, honestly, I believe Wichita State is a hell of a team, and I think they proved it two nights later by beating Alabama as well by double digits. No way WSU should have lost by 30. Yeah, but that was a really good team with a deep front court. I'm being completely sincere when I say if Wichita State had figured out a way to get into the NCAA tournament, they were every bit as scary as a team like VCU or Butler. I mean, they were that good. And so, you know, I think that just sort of shows, like, you know, the parity is the word thrown around a lot. But, you know, I think there were good teams out there that, you know, for whatever reason, got overlooked or didn't make it in or whatever. And there is a lot of quality.
And, you know, it's the way it goes, I guess. But, that is weird. I mean, you know, the Huskies, if they had, you know, lost to Georgia, which was a team they were, I guess, theoretically favored to beat, you know, it would have made the season have sort of definitely a sour taste. You know, if they go to the NIT, I don't think you'd ever say I'd rather win the NIT than even lose a game in the NCAA tournament.
No, and it's not even close.
But, you know, it's sort of the argument that people give for the college bowl system, which is like, you know, 15 teams get to feel like a winner at the end of the year, however many, depending on how many bowl games there's like 30. So 30 teams get to feel like a winner at the end of the year. You know, and you know, in the NCAA, really only three out of 300 and however many teams. Every other team in the NBA or in the NCAA, you know, either is so crappy that they don't make their own conference tournament or they end the season with a loss.
Right. Yeah.
And three teams out of 343, whatever it is, you know, get to finish the season with a win. So, you know, happy times.
Yeah, and, you know, it'd be interesting to see. You know, with Oregon, I think it has to be considered sort of a smashing success because they were so terrible out of conference and then got better in conference. And Dana Altman, you know, did a heck of a coaching job. I think, you know, nobody's going to, I don't think, argue with that. And so that was all great. But, you know, this is strikingly similar to what we heard 2 years ago when Oregon State goes out and wins the CBI and, you know, Craig Robinson is in his, you know, first year, and, you know, it's the team was so terrible under Jay John, and they turned it around, and, you know, all these things. So I'm curious, not to say it's a totally apples to apples comparison, but at the same time, you know, I'm curious to see if Oregon can build on this where Oregon State pretty clearly did not, you know. So I think it's gonna be interesting. But, you know, I mean, like you said, you know, winning stuff is cool. There's nothing wrong with winning. There's nothing wrong with more basketball, and. So good job to the Ducks.
Yeah. I guess.
you know. So anyway, well, I think that about wraps us up. We may drop in here and there. I don't know. We'll see. Maybe we'll see how the NBA draft shakes out or something like that, and give a way too early look on the conference season or whatever as time allows for Seth and I. But we will go ahead and say this is the official end of season two of 18 in Life, the Pac-10 Hoops podcast. So it's been a lot of fun. Seth, thanks a lot for another awesome season.
Yeah, man. Thanks. It was a great season.
Yeah, and hopefully we'll be back around next season for the Pac-10's triumphant return to NCAA glory or something weird like that. So, anyway, for my co-host Seth, I am Jeff. Thank you for joining us today, and thank you for joining us all this season on 18 in Life, the Pac-10 Hoops podcast. We appreciate it. Thank you very much, and we will talk to you at some point in the future.